Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Stanley Kubrick's films have occasionally been criticized as seeming cold or distant. The images and the stories they tell, however, speak another narrative of deeply held, ironically expressed passion, a level of feeling that the viewer has to seek out and be open to. In this lecture, held at the National Gallery of Art on September 2, 2018, acclaimed film scholar Robert P. Kolker illustrates through numerous clips that Kubrick's films often reference specific works of art. The presentation celebrates Kolker's publication of The Extraordinary Image, Orson Welles, Alfred Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick, and the Reimagining of Cinema, an exploration of how movies work, what they mean, and why they bring us so much pleasure. Reflecting on a lifetime of teaching and writing on these filmmakers, in The Extraordinary Image, Kolker offers a deeply personal set of insights on three artists who have changed the way he understands movies.
So I'm going to talk about Kubrick and feeling. And the first question is about engagement. Does too close identification with a work of art and its creator damage critical judgment? Engagement with the objects of desire, identifying with the artists who have created them, create problems of distance and judgment. Full disclosure, I wrote The Extraordinary Image about three directors for whom I have profound feelings. I've met none of them, though I have had the honor of meeting and befriending the Kubrick family. And the emotion I feel comes from an attachment to the creativity of their work, the constant flow of surprise and pleasure that they give me, and a desire to somehow get close to their creator. The emotions come in different degrees. In my younger days, I was infatuated with Orson Welles, the man and his work. I looked on him as a hero battling the insuperable odds of procuring funding for films whose vision was so radically different from the run-of-the-mill conventions of ordinary cinema that ordinary cinema would have none of him. I often felt like a lone admirer of his adaptation of Franz Kafka's The Trial and his autumnal ode to Shakespeare's Falstaff plays, Chimes at Midnight, a film that moved me close to tears. There are large and small moments in Welles's films that stun the senses, that are both full of vitality and lyricism as well. I find this little tracking shot from the Gant's Hill robbery episode in Chimes, one of the most lyrical moments in cinema. Welles knew how to move the camera. Hitchcock is a different story. I'm intrigued by his coldness and the mathematical precision of his best work. I'm overwhelmed by the constricted passion and psychotic expression of male desire in Vertigo. But I hold Hitchcock at a greater distance from the other two filmmakers, never exactly sure what he wants from me, or whether perhaps he's laughing at my response. Kubrick is a story of a different magnitude. I have from time to time imagined a peculiar kind of identification with Stanley Kubrick, given our somewhat similar New York backgrounds, Jewishness, and love of cinema. This admiration leads, of course, to a great deal of inquisitiveness about the filmmaker and his films, an ongoing desire to get to the heart of them, to the heart of my own response, to the heart of their notoriously reticent creator. And what I wish to talk about today is as much an inquiry into the response to his work, my own response and others, and perhaps a corrective to that response. And all of this involves a paradox, a puzzle, that I would like to try and solve. Kubrick's films are notorious for being called cold and distant, the result of a careful calculation, years of preparation, long shoots with a director demanding multiple takes of every scene. The implication is that all the emotion is wrung out of any given film. the result being an aesthetic of icy observation of human cruelty and failure. Yet how does that square with my own, and of course many others' response to the films? I don't find them cold. Their impact perhaps misses me at first sight, but ultimately they become part of my consciousness and my unconscious as well. This is the story of so many of Kubrick's films. They play continually, always on my mind. Like the HAL 2000 computer in 2001, I can feel them. So the questions I want to raise and the puzzle I want to resolve are whether the notions of Kubrickian coldness are valid, and if not, where lie the emotions of a Kubrick film, and why do they spur, in me at least, such a profound feeling of connection, of awe, of sorrow, pleasure? Why, for example, do I react with such hair-raising pleasure to those shockingly symmetrical events at the end of two very different films, Dr. Strangelove's cry, Mein Führer, I Can Walk, and in A Clockwork Orange, Alex's I Was Cured All Right. These are two statements of the triumph of evil in the world, which is the source of such emotion in Kubrick, and why is it so difficult to get at them, or such a surprise when they appear? Let me take Barry Lyndon as an example. It's an ice pack of a movie, wrote the Kubrick phobe Pauline Kael about the film. Kael is not a reliable witness on things Kubrickian, but she voiced a common criticism of the film, which is, in actual fact, one of Kubrick's most moving works. In A Cinema of Loneliness, I wrote something about how Barry Lyndon works. I said, formal beauty should give us pleasure. Kubrick makes it communicate sadness. The film's images become charged with feelings of loss, and in effect enhanced by the dirge-like quality of its music. The more the viewer tries to come to terms with what is seen and felt, the more distance and isolation are forced on him. And I should have added, the more distance and isolation the film might create, the more it is felt, the more it's experienced, the more it is there to respond to, the more replete with sorrow the film and its viewers become. So far, so good. So here is another paradox. The further we are placed from what is going on in the film, the more I respond to it. Let me stay with Barry Lyndon for a moment. The film is the jewel in Kubrick's crown of work, an elegy of lost ambition, a film that uses the past as a lens for the present, a quiet film whose ironies enfold its central character, who is caught between the losing battles he wages to climb the social ladder, and a voiceover narrator who keeps assuring us of his ultimate failure. The elegy of Barry Lyndon is a lacrimae rerum, a sadness of things that moves me as much as anything else in Kubrick, with perhaps one exception, another tracking shot from another film, the astronaut pool jogging and shadowboxing around the circular interior of the Discovery 1 on its way to Jupiter, with Aram Khachaturian playing on the soundtrack. I can think of no other image that so well represents solitary detachment.
Thank you.
In the measured pace of Barry Lyndon and 2001, past, present, and future are folded. Time is spatial, and space makes room for time's inevitable return. Space and time merge and are placed in contention. In this way, the emotional index of the film is measured in the small and large movements of time and space, movements of which all three of my directors were masters and which Kubrick used to maximum effect. Let me return to Barry Lyndon. There is no doubt that Kubrick meant Barry Lyndon to be an emotionally charged work, that Barry's mourning his son's dying, for example, is as sentimental a scene as he ever allowed himself or his characters to indulge in. He even manipulated his source in such an interesting way as to generate the last and lasting wave of feeling from the film. At the very beginning of William Makepeace Thackeray's novel, the film's source, his unpleasant narrator, Barry himself, dismisses his memories of his lineage. It's a sort of throwaway in the course of a larger harangue of the and exposition that the narrator gives us. Now, what happens is that Kubrick discovers the pathos in the middle of this offhanded and dismissive remark in the novel and places it at the very end of his film, a spatial and temporal realignment. Barry, the social climber, has been ruined. I'm going to play something and talk over it. His leg has been amputated. He is effectively castrated. After the freeze frame of Barry entering a coach to take him away, there is a coda. To the dying fall of the Schubert piano trio, we see the remnants of the Lyndon family and their retainers signing checks, their lives reduced to a ceremony of accounting. There are close-ups of Lady Lyndon and Lord Bullingdon, her son, who caused Barry to lose his leg in a duel. Signing the bill for the payment that was part of the deal for Barry's banishment, a look of minor regret, loss, and anger crosses Lady Lyndon's face. A camera zooms into the bill. The year is 1798, a time of great change and revolution. Kubrick then cuts to a far shot, a tableau of the group surrounded by the lavish accoutrements of their class. The shot is held for a time until the final credit card appears. So there it is. The offhanded comment by the narrator early in Thackeray's novel becomes a moving coda to a film about social climbing and melancholy descent. Kubrick's other films do not open their hearts quite as much as Barry Lyndon. Their emotions are held closely, and occasionally, in Dr. Strangelove, for example, emotion becomes caricature, where the demonstration of feeling trips over itself into the performance of madness that brings the world down with it. Here, the passion for destruction becomes a cartoon of the inevitable move towards immolation. This, of course, is just one broad example of what happens when Kubrick wants to generate emotion from a character. He either underplays or overplays. We need to look hard or read in reverse, sometimes ducking an assault. Sometimes the gesture is so broad that it verges into parody, like Turgeson and his comrades in Dr. Strangelove. Sometimes the Kubrickian gaze is a barking madness. Sometimes we see hysteria in the peculiar context of demonstrative rebuttal, such as the hurt response of Charlotte Hayes to Humbert Humbert's amusing musings about his clueless wife in Lolita. The gaze shifts and refocuses, perhaps regarding a forceful argument so strong that it either exposes weakness or withers its opponents, as in the crucial, indeed catastrophic moment in Eyes Wide Shut.
Women don't. They basically just don't think like that.
Millions of years of evolution, right?
We see it in the belittling of the target of its wrath in Full Metal Jacket.
You will not laugh. You will not cry. You will learn by the numbers. I will teach you. Now get up. Get on your feet. You had best unfuck yourself, or I will unscrew your head and chip down your neck.
We see it, serious or comic, coming in bursts or in sustained fury. The emotions generated by the way Kubrick regards his characters can be agonizing and intense, hung out for all to see, or secreted for us to discover. Part of the blood-brain barrier to immediate feeling in Kubrick's films lies in their performative quality. The characters act as if they are always on display. They seem to know this and want us to know it as well. The actors perform their parts. The characters they create perform for us, for the others in the film, for themselves. Recall Turgeson's hysterical rant. We are witness to acting twice or thrice removed, a kind of infinite loop of performance. Kubrick's characters are always aware that we are looking at them. This is no more evident than in A Clockwork Orange, perhaps the slyest film in the Kubrick canon. Alex is always on display for we as viewers, for his droogs, his gang, his victims. After the Ludovico technique, where he has been brainwashed to react negatively to violence, he is directly put on display by Fred, the Minister of the Interior. Alex wheedles and complains over his loss of potency until, rehabilitated, he once again acts out for us, for Fred, a fantasy for all to enjoy, for himself to enjoy in a rebirth that may, like the resurrection of Dr. Strangelove, scare the daylights out of us. But I wonder if scare is the right word. Unlike Hitchcock, Kubrick is never out to frighten his audience. Even in The Shining, his horror film, which is really one of his great comedies, he is the poet of extraordinary vision and images, and the emotional force of that vision lies in the ability of his films to make us want to see, not turn away, but see in a way that is most unusual in the context of filmmaking conventions. If we expand on the performative aspect of the films to the ways in which emotion in general is created, we can understand that emotion is, with few exceptions, generated through acts of extroversion and or inversion, upside down, if you will. Emotion lies within or beneath the ironic surface, the too much seen, that complex surface that is so often accused of being cold and encases a Kubrick film. The films challenge us to understand how their rhetorical stance needs to be parsed in order to see the passion that drives it. Let me return to A Clockwork Orange. I said that this was the slyest film in the canon, but I might also say more strongly that it is a film that demands more from the viewer than can possibly be managed. Too much of a demand. The film sets up a false dialectic, accepts extreme violence of its protagonist, Alex, including rape and murder, because it is an expression of free will, or condemn it and approve of the Ludovico technique that he undergoes at the bequest of the state that removes free will. Violence or zombie-like state control, the deck is certainly stacked. We are tied to Alex from the very first shot. From his diabolical gaze and his fetching voice, Alex acts and talks and talks and talks, prideful, self-pitying, always in control, even when he is not in control. The images of the film are so brilliant, so full of activity, the soundtrack so hypnotic, that we are disallowed breathing room, thinking room, feeling room. We need, with this film, as with so many other of Kubrick's other works, emotion recollected in tranquility, the tranquility that the film disallows at the moment of viewing. And what do we then feel? Inescapable elation at the sheer energy of the work, troubled by its apparent celebration of violence. Why the inescapable desire to return to it? Desire recollected in tranquility, delight in the force of the creative imagination. Perhaps the primary emotion engendered by a Kubrick film is desire to see it again and again, an experience shared with Hitchcock and Wells. We want to own it in some kind of intellectual and emotional way, a repetition compulsion that is stronger, in my experience, in Kubrick than in Wells or Hitchcock. But for this to happen, there has to be an emotional as well as an intellectual base to start with. And that brings us back to the original question. What is it about a Kubrick film that generates such a desire? The pleasure of form, certainly, perhaps most especially. As James Naramore said, Kubrick is the last of the great high modernists, that movement of writers, poets, painters, musicians, and filmmakers who look to the perfection of the formal structure of their art as their highest goal. Meaning emerges from form. Content is determined by form. Emotion is determined by form. We know that Kubrick's attraction to early 20th century modernist Vienna was made manifest in Eyes Wide Shut. His love of Schnitzler and Gustav Klimt glows in the set design of that film. And there's certainly signs of attraction to American modernist painting as well. Look at these images by Mark Rothko and Kubrick. Kubrick, as Barry Lyndon certainly shows us, was deeply engaged with painting and the painterly image, in this case, of the 17th and 18th century in Barry Lyndon. The rigors of composition coming from painting as well as from his early work in still photography create attention to the formal properties of the image. The symmetrical framing and 90-degree position in front of the subject, placing the camera so that the vanishing point focuses our attention to the rear. The breaking of the 180-degree rule, that unspoken rule that says the camera may never leap from one side of the subject to the opposite side of the subject, But here is Kubrick breaking it in the bathroom sequence in The Shining. One side of us to the opposite. These effects push our attention, startle us. Our attention is arrested by the strength of the formal properties of the image, and the emotional surge of the uncanny flows from it. But what about the image and its narrative content? What do the careful compositions, the startling editing, the exaggerated performances in the films tell us? What is the emotional residue of Kubrick's modernist project? The modernist mode is ironic, the diminishment of its subject. Looking down, as Northrop Frye says in his Anatomy of Criticism, on a scene of bondage, frustration, or absurdity. We see this clearly in Strangelove, but it is apparent in perhaps more subtle ways across the Kubrick canon, and is present as well in many of the films of Wells and Hitchcock. Does this suggest that after the startle effect of formal visual perfection, our response is pity towards the characters that we look down on? Flailing and failing in their attempts to overcome their own absurdity? Pity is an emotion Kubrick's film is an effect that Kubrick's films try hard to deflect. We can look at the dialogue between Colonel Dax and General Brulard at the end of Paths of Glory, where the word pity is tossed around as an impotent insult without any meaning.
You're an idealist, and I pity you. Is that what the village is? We're fighting a war, Dax, a war that we've got to win. Those men didn't fight, so they were shot. You bring charges against General Monroe, so I insist that he answer.
The isolation and pain of Barry Lyndon at the end of his film is heartbreaking, not pitiable. Even Johnny Clay, staring glassy-eyed and depressed as his money swirls into the air at the end of the killing, does not elicit pity, but rather the reaction of quiet amazement at the banal undoing of a simple man who erected a scheme that left no room for the inevitable display of contingency. These characters are lost, but lost only after great effort. They are destroyed and regarded with sorrow, not as objects of pity. So many of Kubrick's characters work hard at their ultimate undoing. In the dark womb of the war room, in Dr. Strangelove, the end of the world comes only after much absurd struggle with the relentless, intractable language of the Cold War, and the rebirth of a barely dominant fascism. We look down at small-minded men whose helplessness is gauged only by the sense of their own idiotic power. There is no pity here, only delighted amazement, perhaps even a certain sadness at the recognition about the ways power always defeats the people who try to attain it and maintain it. And in Dr. Strangelove, there is some schadenfreude as we see our world go up in an orgasm of absurdity. As always, the defeat of power is a steady theme in Kubrick's films. The ironies of exertion foiled by absurd means in extraordinary circumstances. Full Metal Jacket provides a particularly interesting example. The first half of the film is a challenging mixture of comedy and brutality, what with Hartman's over-the-top haranguing of his Marine trainees and the growing antipathy to Private Pyle. The nighttime sequence of the men beating Pyle with bars of soap is one of the most excruciatingly painful in Kubrick's films. The emotional temperature here is high indeed for a sequence that is both repellent and full of sorrow and anger, especially at Joker's betrayal of the man he befriended and who joins his companions in torturing the hopeless and hapless recruit. But our response is carefully manipulated. From feeling horrified for Pyle, we are moved to a certain relief when he seems to become an expert marksman, along with wariness at his growing obsession with his rifle. His grotesque murder and suicide, which ends the first part of the film, leaves a void, visibly presented by the fade to black, which shifts location to Vietnam and the song "These Boots Are Made for Walking," the song of female aggressiveness, a prophetic song that will be realized at the end of the film when a woman Viet Cong sniper decimates the platoon. The end of Full Metal Jacket presents a complex mix of emotions. There is the agonizing image of the sniper writhing in pain, begging to be killed. There is the hesitation of Joker and his final decision to follow his training, his slogan, "Born to Kill," and the reaction of his colleagues calling out "hardcore" with its double meaning, each one reprehensible. We are left with a feeling of uncomfortable futility and maybe a certain sympathy with the soldiers marching off, singing the Mickey Mouse song with the fires of hell behind them. I say sympathy, but in fact, Full Metal Jacket is the most difficult of Kubrick's films to parse thematically or emotionally. As a culmination of his career-long interest in war and the war film, it seems the most undetermined, as opposed to overdetermined by a detectable point of view. The pain of war is made as clear as is the infantilization of the troops. Their neutered hypersexuality is strongly represented, bluntly and without apology. But I find the irony of all of this unrevealing, and even more than A Clockwork Orange, I am uncertain as to where I am placed, what reactions expected of me. War is hell, we know that. But if war is understood as a product of buffoonery and confusion, there may be the key. The expunging of the recruit's humanity by Gunnery Sergeant Hartman in the first part of the film, the bloody rout of the troops by a female sniper at the end, upends every gender insult that Hartman had drilled into his grunts. War is the diminution of the human spirit, the destruction of emotion, turning softness into hardcore. The last words of the film are, "I am not afraid," when in fact the characters are very afraid. The absence of a center is finally what Full Metal Jacket is about. And the result is not so much the emotion of loss as in some other Kubrick films, but a hollowness at the core of the soul, a battleground in the void, looking down on a scene of bondage, frustration, or absurdity. But this is yet another interesting paradox. The ironic mode, carefully understood and appreciated, should lead not only to an understanding of the character's despair, but to a sense of elation, a reaction, for one thing, to the release the films offer from old conventions and generic expectations. We respond to surprise and delight to the changes Kubrick plays on the science fiction film, the horror film, the war film. Looking down, we experience our own liberation. Once again, form triumphs, and out of the triumph of form comes the response to the plight of the characters. No heroes emerge. We feel for them. We are liberated from them. Dave Bowman battles a computer and loses. Jack is frozen in the labyrinth of his own patriotic muddle. Private Joker is trapped in the stupefaction of gender reversal, undone by and then killing a woman. Bill Harford, in Eyes Wide Shut, seeks sexual release outside the trying comforts of the domestic. There is a perverse pleasure in the absurdity, an emotional response to the humbling of these characters, admiration for the skill with which that humbling has been engineered. The catharsis of release, amazement at the force of pure cinematic pleasure. Northrop Frye said that if any literary work is emotionally depressing, there is something wrong, either in the writing or the reader's response. Art seems to produce a kind of buoyance, exuberance. Kubrick's art is perfection. The reader's or viewer's response should be an exuberant response to it. This brings me again to Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick's most complex, most heartfelt, most maddening film. As a personal note, when I first saw Eyes Wide Shut in a rundown theater in Naples, Florida, this was the case so often in the pre-digital days, the projector lamp was too dim, the focus was not perfect. Just the kinds of problems that Kubrick tried to rectify during his life when he oversaw the distribution and exhibition of his films. He left nothing to choice. He wrote instructions to projectionists on how exactly to show his films. Perhaps that contributed to my disappointment. I came away wondering what Kubrick was thinking. What was going on in this film that seemed at first look flat, mannered, and endless? Was the orgy sequence some kind of joke? Were the celebrity stars, Cruise and Kidman, there as dressing? The questions went on and on, as did my viewing, reviewing, teaching, and writing about the film. Even now, 19 years later, even after co-authoring a book on the making of the film, I don't have all the answers. But I do know that even hearing Shostakovich's Jazz Suite, the main theme music of the film, triggers a strong emotional response. These are emotions generated by a film that excavates the depths of sexual longing and insecurity, a film that transgresses by fusing the boundaries of wakefulness and dreams and desire. It is just there that understanding the emotional power of Eyes Wide Shut and perhaps all of Kubrick begins. In dreams begin responsibilities, wrote Delmore Schwartz. The imagination carries the debt owed to the unconscious and pays it in film by creating worlds that are sometimes dreamlike or that exist as in the interstices of dream and wakefulness, the hypnagogic state. In Eyes Wide Shut, there are no markers to indicate the change from wake to dream. Kubrick gives us few cues, like the mask that appears next to sleeping Alice, mysteriously, when Bill returns from the second round of his odyssey. After his wife has told him that she has a sexual imagination of her own, Bill goes off twice in search of proof of his own desire. When, after his first round, he returns from the orgy, Alice tells Bill about a dream she had, which just happened to be a dream about an orgy. And throughout the film, Bill has dreamlike imaginings of the naval officer making love to Alice. The orgy itself, presented as there, happening to Bill, and in front of our eyes, yet so fantastic, in the end so sublimely over-imagined that it is hard to accept as real. At one point, Bill is asked to remove his clothes, and who has not had that dream? And no dream is ever just a dream, says Bill during the final sequence of the film. He seems to accept his limits, though with the knowledge gained from his peregrinations through the imagined New York streets and the erotic haunts of the super rich, he seems, in fact, to suddenly understand Freud. Alice, his wife, wants less lofty reflections. She states her love, but insist there is something they must do right away.
And you know, there is something very important that we need to do as soon as possible.
What's that?
Does Alice want to do away with dreams to get back to the quotidian wakefulness of the pleasures of the body? She needs to work hard on Bill. He is perhaps the only Kubrick character who is given so many warnings against so many foiled opportunities to act badly, which of course he ignores, at least until his final epiphany. Bill Harford in Nighttown is a journey of frustration, of repetition, of uncanny coincidence, a cycle of error, and perhaps as close to redemption as any Kubrick character comes. It's worth a moment to look at this, because Bill's journey keeps revealing more and more on each viewing and holds some of the keys to the film's emotional core. Let me go over a few of the film's events. After his wife tells him about her imagining of being in love and making love to a sailor, he goes out on his first voyage and visits the home of a patient who has died. The dead man's wife declares her love for him. The corpse lies in the bed behind them, only to be interrupted by the arrival of her boyfriend. On the street, and I'll show this clip and talk over it. On the street, he sees in a tracking shot reminiscent of Hitchcock, he walks, looks. There is a cut to his point of view of a couple making out. The sight makes him fantasize, dream his wife making love to the Navy man. It was this admission of her desire for a naval officer that sent him over the edge and onto the streets. He continues. He is attacked. He is attacked and gay baited by a rowdy group of frat boys. He walks, continues walking, and meets a prostitute. In the course of the odyssey that he undertakes to match his desire with his wife's, Bill is stymied at every point. Alice phones Bill, interrupting his foreplay with the prostitute. Coitus interruptus becomes the pattern for poor Bill throughout his wanderings, even in the orgy. As if he were moving through the ill-defined spaces of his own insatiable, never-to-be-satisfied libido, everything from the people he meets to the shops he passes and the graffiti on the walls to the orgy itself reflects his sexual desire, confusion, and insecurity. The viewer is held in Bill's own suspension, and again, a strong sense of anxiety follows. From this point on, his odyssey becomes stranger and stranger. Bill's unconscious is erupting despite all his efforts to repress it. That group of boys who attack him, reminiscent of Alex's gang in A Clockwork Orange, gay bait Bill and knock him over. In his second voyage, he will question a gay hotel clerk who tries to come on to him. A prostitute takes him to her cramped, dirty apartment, a book, Theory of Sociology, lying nearby. Her name is Domino, an old word for a mask. While at home, Alice watches on television Paul Mazursky's 1973 film Bloom in Love. Mazursky was a childhood friend of Kubrick's and had the role of Sidney, the crazed soldier, in his first feature, Fear and Desire. The movie she's watching, Bloom in Love, is about marital infidelity. The ironies of a waking dream world, so carefully made, so full of allusions and doublings, so filled with disappointments, the spaces Bill traverses are deeply marked, signed, as it were, with the names of shops, graffiti on the walls, newspaper headlines. "Lucky to be alive," shouts a headline from the New York Post that Bill picks up on his second round following his return home after the orgy. The newsstand where he gets the paper is a visual allusion to the young Kubrick's most famous photograph for Look magazine of a newsstand showing the headline of the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Allusion marks the spaces of Bill's odyssey, from the movie Alice Watches to the book on Domino's shelf to the Sonata Jazz Club where Bill learns the password to the orgy, which is Fidelio, Beethoven's opera about a faithful wife who disguises herself as a man to save her husband from prison. The allusory, oniric nature of Eyes Wide Shut puts us yet into another level of abstraction and expectation, even a certain anxiety. Can we recognize all the allusions? Do we understand why they are there and what their meaning is within the context of the film? Eyes Wide Shut is an interesting collaboration with the viewer, a test of sorts. Do we know the Kubrick canon? Are we comfortable enough with the history of cinema to appreciate the ways in which the film embraces it? As significant as the allusions that occur in the dream work of the film is its careful and controlled structure. It follows the classic sonata form of music, with an introduction, exposition, development, recapitulation, and coda. There is something perfectly ordered, a narrative exquisitely worked out with a Freudian base and a musical structure, a pattern that Kubrick, the rationalist attracted to the uncanny logic of the unconscious, allows to represent a world half awake and half asleep. The viewer is uncomfortably slipped between this double vision, this unresolved song of desire unsatisfied, of domesticity earned at a cost, of dreams acknowledged out of the necessities of waking life. I find it amazing that as difficult and even unattractive as I found Eyes Wide Shut when I first saw it, I still can't seem to stop talking about it. Reviewing and reviewing and reviewing it. More than any other Kubrick film, it takes time and constant looking to get to all its complexities. As these are unraveled, the film takes on more meaning and provokes my desire to see even more. So, we return to where we started. Kubrick's films have been accused of being cold, though, as I hope I've shown, they are in fact seething with emotion, but emotion that needs to be accessed through the intellect. By seeing more, understanding more, being amazed again and again, the film's emotions bubble through, and in the end, every Kubrick film becomes an addiction, a desire, indeed a need to embrace their uncanny, their astonishing images, their burning intellectual passion. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.